MacCast, Sunday, January 20th, 2013. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. Glad to have you back here with us. We've got a bunch of great Mac news and tips and tricks and information to get into in this episode once again, but before we dive in, let me take a quick moment and thank one of our show sponsors, actually a new sponsor here on the MacCast. It's ShareFile by Citrix. How many of us have had this happen? So you try to email a file or a document to a client and it ends up getting bounced because it's too big. Or maybe you need to share a file, but it's something confidential, something you need to know is secure. Security a little more robust than just an obfuscated URL. Or maybe you need to access that one file from your work computer from the office that you forgot to copy over to your laptop before you headed out on that business trip. ShareFile by Citrix offers a solution to all of these problems and more. They actually designed ShareFile specifically for business, and it lets you send files of almost any size and provides access from any computer or mobile device. What I really liked about ShareFile is how you can integrate it into your business. They offer branding options and widgets. You can create a branded experience with your logo and colors to match your identity. So when your clients are accessing files, they get that branded experience. They also have these widgets that allow you to do things like add login and file upload directly to your site. And you can share files and receive files just by sending emails. The customer gets a link to download or upload those files through that branded experience. So you can let them access those pages. They can do it securely. You can even set limits on things like how many times a file can be downloaded per person or how long those files are available for download. So you don't have to go to remember to pull them back down off of your server. And I really like the upload thing because how often has it been you need to get a client to send you a file and they can't because their email is blocking it and they don't really understand FTP. You don't want to get them into something that's really technical. You want to make it simple and easy, and ShareFile does that. You have to try ShareFile today. To get started, there is a risk-free trial offer. You can try it out free for 30 days. Just go to sharefile.com, click on the little radio microphone, and make sure you enter my offer code MACCAST. Remember, visit sharefile.com and type in my offer code MACCAST. And a big thank you to Citrix and ShareFile for their support of the MACCAST. Kicking off the news for this week, there's another report that makes it look like Apple is scaling back on their production, this time on the 9.7-inch iPad. Reuters claims that sources told them that Sharp has nearly halted production of the panels for Apple. Now, Apple does also use Samsung and LG Display for 9.7-inch display production, and there are no reports that either of those suppliers are slowing down their production. So that does leave the reason for the Sharp report up to some speculation. It could be because there's weak demand for the fourth-generation iPad due to cannibalization from the iPad mini and also reduced sales due to other tablets hitting the market. It could simply also be a post-holiday reduction as Apple moves into a slower period of sales. It's probably actually a combination of both those things. We've also been hearing those rumors of an iPad refresh and a move to Sharp's IGZO display technology, but those orders might actually be coming from some of Sharp's licensees like AU Optronic and Intellux Corporation, rather than Sharp directly. The CEO of Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing Company said he expects his company will be responsible for 100% of the 28-nanometer chip production in 2013. A bold statement to be sure, but they say their shipments of 28-nanometer chips will triple in 2013. The question is, where are all those chips going? They, of course, didn't say, but we've been hearing so many rumors of Apple moving its A-series chip production from Samsung to TSMC that it's hard to believe the large boost doesn't have at least something to do with a big new Apple contract. TSMC supposedly is already creating trial batches of the A6X processor for the fourth generation iPads, and assuming the tests have run well, it seems logical to me that Apple would want to move future A-series designs to the 28 nanometer process. Samsung currently makes chips for Apple in a Texas-based facility, and it is assumed that Apple would want to continue chip production in the States. Conveniently, there have also been rumors of TSMC planning to build a U.S.-based foundry. I think there's likely little debate that the press and Wall Street have been having a field day with Apple, giving them quite a beating in the media. It actually feels to me like the 90s all over again, with the media predicting the fall of Apple. As we discussed last week, many are saying that iPhone 5 sales are failing to meet expectations. Here's the thing, though. The iPhone 5 isn't the only iPhone that Apple sells, and even if it was, Apple still is selling a ton of them. A couple of analysts looked at the iPhone, actually all models of the iPhone sales, versus Samsung Galaxy phone sales for the past 2.5 years, and it turns out that Apple outsold Samsung devices 219 million to 113 million. That's about an 88 million difference for those of you who are counting. And in case you're saying, well, yeah, but the Galaxy S3 is doing gangbusters and just came out in June, you'd be right. Samsung announced recently that they had sold about 40 million of the units. But the study also shows that the iPhone 5 sales are right around 40 million as well. That's by the end of December 2012, and the iPhone 5 just went on sale in September. Perspective is an interesting thing, and to be sure, the Samsung Galaxy is a great contender. It's very popular. I just think it might be a bit premature to be saying that it has the iPhone on the ropes. Also, on those rumors of supply cutbacks due to waning iPhone demand, Display Research told CNET it's likely just a cutback because Apple no longer needs the large volumes that it had to get ramped up for the initial onslaught of iPhone 5 demand. Now that things have calmed down a bit, Apple is adjusting for the move into steadier times and sales. In reality, the first quarter shipments of the iPhone 5 are above those of the first quarter shipments for the iPhone 4S, showing that demand remains strong. Apple is expected to announce Q1 iPhone shipments somewhere in the range of 33 to 42 million units. I'd say hardly a flop by almost any account. And then finally in the news, there's a bit of an odd report coming from the China Times. I say odd mainly because of the name that they're reporting on what they say is a second model of the iPhone that will be released alongside the rumored iPhone 5S in June. The translation of the report says that they're calling it the iPhone Math, M-A-T-H. To me, that's either a code name, and a really bad one at that, or a translation error. Maybe it was supposed to be something like iPhone Max, which to me would make more sense because we'd heard rumors of a smaller iPhone being something called the iPhone Mini, and so you'd have mini iPhones and max iPhones. At any rate, the big deal, pun intended, with the math is that it would support a large 4.8-inch display. The story claims that both the iPhone 5S and the Math would also offer 8-megapixel cameras. And then the report gets odd again because not only would Apple update the iPhone in June, they're reporting that there would be another update around the holiday season of 2013 where Apple would upgrade the camera to a 12-megapixel one. The report names suppliers and says that Hanhai Precision Industries Corporation Limited would undertake about 90% of the manufacturing orders for the new device. Mac Rumors points out that they aren't the first to claim that Apple is working on a 4.8-inch version of the iPhone. Jefferies analyst Peter Misick made a similar claim back in December, although last week he said that he hadn't heard anything more about it recently. Several analysts have mentioned Apple working on multiple size and multiple price points for iPhones in the future. I've mentioned that the iPhone is likely to see some diversification now that the product line has matured and that demand seems to be leveling off. I'm not sure that a 4.8-inch screen is the right move, though, as developers are still adapting to the taller 4-inch screen on the iPhone 4S. I assume that a 4.8-inch display would be a whole new set of resolutions for app developers to have to deal with, and I'm not sure that Apple really wants to add that complexity to the current ecosystem. So I don't know. What do you think? Is Apple going to finally bring out a bigger iPhone, something more toward the 5-inch screen range? We've been seeing their competitors just driving up the sizes of those displays. I think we're hearing about 5.8-inch displays now. I think even at CES, there was a phone that offered a 6-inch display. To me, those are getting way too huge, but I don't know. What do you think? Send me some feedback and let me know. But with that, that's going to do it for the news for this week. A little bit shorter than normal, but before we move on, I do want to take another moment and thank one of our show sponsors. That's Smile. You know, Text Expander is one of those applications that I just don't know how I would get by without it. I don't remember the time when I didn't have it. It's on all of my Macs. And it lets you set up these abbreviations, little shorthand codes that you can type and then become expanded into these much longer blocks of text. And so it's great for any situation where you find yourself repeatedly typing the same thing. I use it for my email responses. I use it for programming. It's got this great little set of snippets that you can download that'll add accents to different words automatically. So if you type out a word like doppelganger, for example, it'll automatically add that little umlaut for you. You don't have to remember the keyboard shortcut for that. And best of all, in your emails, even though you're building out these sort of preset snippets, they don't have to look like or feel like they're canned because you have options like fill-in forms that let you customize the text as it's being expanded. You can also set up optional sections and include or exclude them with a simple check mark. You can sync your snippets between your Macs over your network or via Dropbox. Also, they have Text Expander Touch, which can let you take your snippets with you on the go. And the API is integrated on iOS with over 147 of the most popular apps. So that gets around the limitations of iOS, where you can't have it built into the core of the operating system. It's built into all the apps that you're going to want to use, and it'll recognize your snippets and expand them without having to jump back and forth between applications. If you don't have a copy of Text Expander yet, what are you waiting for? Just go to the website now. You can get a copy, and if you're still not sure, you can at least give the free trial a spin. Great software. Also, while you're there, check out their other great applications, smilesoftware.com, and a big thank you to them for their support of the MacCast. On the last show, you'll remember we were talking a little bit about security and specifically the Java update that came out from Oracle to deal with some zero-day exploits that had happened over there. And Mike emailed me to make a couple comments on some of the things that I said about the JDK and the Java runtime environment. He says, I just wanted to let you know that installing the JDK does not quote-unquote, blow away Apple's version. Major Java versions are installed into their own directories. Similarly, installing the Java 7 JRE is essentially no different than installing the plugin. The macOS 10 version of Java 7 includes the plugin and JRE in the same bundle. There's no way on any platform to just install a browser plugin without the JRE. And I happen to know that Mike is a Java developer, so he knows what he's talking about. And Mike, yes, you're technically correct. I deliberately oversimplified some of my comments because the net effect of running the Java 7 JDK installer is like blowing away Java 6 on your Mac. So I should have been a little more clear. It does technically leave Java 6 in place, but what happens when you install the Java 7 JDK from Oracle is that it changes the JRE that is used by default by your system. And in order to switch back, you have to do something like issue terminal commands or go in and change your app's configuration. And that might not be simple for it, for everyone. So if you run the JRE installer for Java 7 from Oracle on your Mac, it will most likely break most of your existing Java-based applications that you already have installed, the ones that rely on Java 6. So it's like the old Java has been replaced, at least from the perspective of the user. The reason it happens like that, just for those of you who might want to know, is that Apple uses a symbolic link, an alias at the default level for Java. So Java would normally look for the path /user/bin/Java, and Apple puts a little alias at that point that links actually to system library frameworks, javavm.framework, versions current, commands, Java, which I believe always references the most current version of Java that you have installed on your system. So even though Java 6 is left in place, those references get updated and the apps will look to the default location, which now references that new updated version of Java on your system, the JRE on your system. And yes, Mike, you are correct on your plugin statement as well. And I believe I said that in my report, but maybe I didn't make it really clear. It wasn't quite understandable with how the whole thing works. You do need to have the JRE installed for a plugin to work. In the past, what would happen when you would install a plugin for Java in your browser is that it would rely on the Java runtime environment that was installed with the system. This time around, for the Mac OS X plugin, I guess Oracle wanted to make sure that you were using the very latest version of the Java 7 runtime environment, but they didn't want to install a JRE, a version of Java 7 JRE at the root level. So what they did was they baked a copy of the JRE 1.7.0.12 into the plugin itself. So when you add the plugin or you go to get the update from the Oracle website, it updates the plugin and it puts in a JRE within the whole package that will be used by your browser. So it's not going to use the system level version, the Java 6 version that most of us have running. So Mike, I appreciate the feedback because that helps clarify things a little bit and is more technically accurate. I probably should have done that from the get-go, and thanks for your email letting me know about that. A few shows ago, I gave you some of my opinions and thoughts, things I had been thinking about related to app stores and app store pricing, specifically as it relates to Apple and iOS. And I commented that one of the things that I think is frustrating for developers is the inability to give out trial versions of their applications within that ecosystem, at least in a way that makes a lot of sense or is real easy for the end user. And I got this great tip, because we've been getting some great feedback from you. We got this great tip from Randy.
Adam, recently you've been talking about the Mac App Store and the lack of the ability to download a trial software from there. And one way that I've gotten around this, for example, recently, before I purchased the application iFlix, when I found it on the App Store, I clicked on the link that takes you to the developer's website. And from that site, he does offer the ability to download a trial version. So while I couldn't do it directly in the App Store, which I agree would be great, at least I was able to quickly find his website, download a trial version, and then purchase it through the App Store after I made my decision. Hopefully that's information that will help someone else. Enjoy the show a lot, and I really appreciate you being out there for us. Thank you.
You're welcome, Randy, and thank you for the suggestion. It's really great. You know, it's something that's easy to forget about, that little link is there, and just clicking that and checking the developer's website real quick might give you access, like you found out, to a free trial. In case you haven't noticed that little link to the developer's website, it's right there at the top of the right-hand column on the apps page in the Mac App Store. It still would be nice, as you mentioned, Randy, if there was a way to not have to go through those extra steps to jump out to the website and then download a trial version and then go back to the App Store to buy it. Because very often, if you download the trial version, the developer will have a way for you to activate the software right from within the app. So you don't have to go through re-downloading, which could be a big deal depending upon what your bandwidth and internet connection situation is like. I also still worry about the lack of ability to offer paid upgrades through the App Store versions and even the Mac App Store versions of applications. And of course, there's still that problem of no free trials or no real good trial system on iOS apps, you know, aside from developers having to do that whole free or light version of the app. And then you still have to download a separate app if you want to get the paid version. Some app developers are doing some creative things with the in-app purchase, but at the end of the day, it all just feels a little bit kludgy, but maybe that's what we're adapting into. And actually, that's an interesting thing to think about, and it's, you know, related to this whole conversation about app pricing and whether or not low prices make a sustainable model for developers. And the question becomes, are we going to have to adapt to something different, or are developers going to have to adapt to some different model for making business work off of the App Store. And Boy Genius Report had a interesting report this week that I thought was relevant to maybe what those changes are, or could be pointing to what those changes are. I'll have a link to their report in the show notes at maccast.com. But in essence, what they did is they looked at the top grossing apps versus paid apps on the iTunes store. And what they found was that this last week, Pages dropped off of the top 10 list of the top 10 grossing apps on the iTunes store, meaning that there were only free apps in the top grossing apps list. So nothing that's paid for directly up front is currently in the top grossing list. But then they also noticed a similar trend in iPhone apps. I guess there's currently only one paid app in the top grossing list for iPhone apps. And so the question then becomes, well, how are these apps grossing money? How are they making the most money? And it's all about that in-app purchase. What's even more interesting is that many of the top money-making apps, the top grossing apps, are not ranked particularly high in terms of being the top downloaded apps. So they're not necessarily the most popular, but they're actually generating the most revenue. And when you start to think about that, that could be a shift in sort of how you make money from an app. And I'm personally not really sure how I feel about it. On the one hand, it's a solution, potential solution to this problem of downward sliding app prices. You can make your app free and then make your money some other way. And if an app developer can get you to pay the $15 or $20 net for that application through in-app upgrades and additional add-ons, maybe it solves this problem of the upfront pricing being too low. The thing is that not all apps, I think, lend themselves to that particular model, but maybe that's more of a challenge for developers. Maybe it just takes some creative thinking to figure out, okay, how can I offer a freemium app, put that on the App Store for free, and then make money? And there's a lot of apps that are doing that in creative ways, and we're likely to see more of that because of things like what this Boy Genius report discovered. I also personally don't like the model, and that really shouldn't be a strike against it, but to me it often comes off as... sneaky is probably too big a word, but I think of words like sneaky or disingenuous. I don't think that's the intent or what's going on, but you pull that app down and you realize to get the functionality that you really wanted out of it, you need to fork over some money. So it's really not truly free at this point. Two applications that I've purchased that I absolutely love that do this model are Hipstamatic and Paper by 53. I love these applications, but to truly get the functionality I wanted, I've paid, you know, $8 to $20, dependent upon the app, through in-app purchase to get it to be the app that I really like. I kind of wish Paper would have just charged me, for example, $10 up front and then given me access to all the features that I didn't have to go through and sort of pick and choose, go through this in-app purchase. Same kind of thing with the Hipstamatic and their different films and cameras and lenses and lights and stuff like that. If they had just said, look, it's a $20 app, you have access to everything, that's how I would have preferred it. But again, that's me personally. It's probably me being a little bit selfish, because with in-app purchase, you can kind of have it both ways, right? You... free gets you at least something and can serve as that try before you buy option for a lot of customers, the thing that Apple isn't providing to developers. So it's easy to see why developers are moving toward this model. And then customers can choose to just add the features they want without having to subsidize maybe the features that they don't like. So I bet there's a lot of people who like using the free version of Paper and they're perfectly happy with just one pen. If you want additional pens or tools, you can pay a little bit more and get more of those. And they even offer like the premium pack where you get access to everything, which was the option that I chose. So it does give you a lot of flexibility, gives flexibility to the consumer, and it could potentially be another way to charge for quote-unquote upgrades, right? A developer can add on additional features incrementally and get additional incremental revenue and ongoing revenue from an app, something, once again, that I think the overall App Store model should just offer developers but currently doesn't. So I'm not really sure how I feel about this. It's probably just a mind shift. Like, I have to change my thinking because I'm so used to the old school models of I buy an application, I buy something like Photoshop, and I have everything. But I can see this trend forward where you get a basic version of the application, and then through in-app purchase, you mix and match the features that you'd like. And maybe in the long run, that's a better model and something that consumers are going to be really open to. It seems to have been forced at this point, but maybe we're finding our way, and this could be the future of apps and how developers and companies continue to thrive and make money at this sort of stuff. But let me know. What do you think? Is this sort of the trend moving forward? Do you like it? Do you hate it? How do you prefer to have it? Shoot me some feedback. I think we talked a bit on the last show about the 27-inch iMac and some of the delays Apple was having in shipping those out to customers. A lot of you have put your orders in and you're waiting anxiously on that 27-inch model. The displays are rumored to be part of the production problem, that there's some yield problems with those larger panels and the new laminated display technology, what have you, and that might be causing the delays. But I got some feedback from Matt. He ordered his 27-inch iMac back in December. He gave me a little update on the progress, how long it's been taking, and then he also had a question for us.
Hi, Adam. This is Matt. I wanted to reach out with both an update and a question. The update that I had is good news, in that my 27-inch iMac should be coming fairly soon. I placed an order through MacMall.com on December 16th of late last year and received an update from them just the other day that they are getting the shipment of the iMac from Apple on January 29th. So I should receive it about a week after that. So that's good news. I can't wait to get that. My question that I had is a bug that I've noticed in iCloud, meaning iCloud.com. When I use the contacts in iCloud.com, specifically when entering a search within that feature online. So for instance, if I were looking for you and I typed in MacCast in the search area in the upper left of contacts on iCloud.com, and you were to pop up, and on the right side, when it shows your contact, it shows in highlighted in yellow anything that has been typed into the search menu, namely MacCast. So when I go to copy your email, maccast@gmail.com, what is actually copied into the clipboard, which you can see by evidence of pasting it, is what you typed in the search bar and then the entire thing that you highlighted. So what actually is in your clipboard is maccast@gmail.com. I'd encourage you to play around with this just to confirm that this is the case, because I've noticed this ever since the last few iterations of iCloud using contact search. So keep up the great work. Look forward to listening to the next episode. Take care.
Hey, Matt, thanks for the comment. Wow, that seems like almost about 8 weeks, if I'm doing my math right, on getting that 27-inch iMac. A long time, to be sure, but I think based on the reviews I've been reading, it's going to be well worth the wait. So enjoy that new Mac when it comes, and let us know what you think, how you're enjoying the upgrade. I was able to confirm your iCloud.com issue. I don't use iCloud.com too much, so I went unnoticed by me, but maybe some others in the community have noticed that bug. It's very odd, and I would imagine a bit irritating. As far as what you can do about it, it's probably something that Apple is going to have to fix because it's in their web code. I would imagine it has something to do with the JavaScript, possibly. It's weird that it happens when you select the text in the browser, like it's picking up that extra selection. Maybe that highlighting is forcing that into the selection as you do your copy and paste. The one thing I did find is a sort of workaround, at least if you use Safari. I didn't try this on any other browser, but if rather than selecting the text within the browser and doing Command C, a straight copy and then paste, if you simply control click or right click on the email address in that right hand panel, you'll notice in the contextual menu that comes up, there's a copy email address option or copy address option. I don't remember specifically what it says. If you use that, it will just pick up the email address. And I think that's part of the data detectors that might be built into Safari. So again, it might not work on all browsers, but if you're a Safari user, you might give that a shot. And that could potentially help you with the issue. If anybody else has a suggestion for Matt, shoot me an email, maccast@gmail.com, and we'll try and forward that on to him. But odd iCloud issue for sure. And then finally for today, I guess staying in the iCloud realm, I received an email from Patrick, And Patrick's been using iCloud to back up his iOS devices and using the free 5 gigabyte account that you get, but was quickly running out of space, and he wanted to be able to back up multiple devices. So he decided that he would upgrade his storage so that he could do that, and the upgrade went fine. But when he tried to back up both of his devices now, he realized that it was telling him there wasn't enough space and it wouldn't let him perform the backup. And he had just upgraded to a total storage of 15 gigs, which was really plenty for both devices that he wanted to back up. But since there was already backups there from when he had his free account, what ended up happening was there was not a total amount of free space available for the new backups that he was trying to perform. So he shot me an email to ask, you know, how do I delete those old iCloud backups so I can, in essence, start over from scratch? I want to blow away what's already up there, giving me the full 15 gigs available to perform my iCloud backups. And Patrick, the first thing that I would tell you is make sure that you connect your devices to iTunes. And even though you're doing your backups through iCloud, force a local sync and make sure that you have a local backup of both devices before you go in and blow away what's out there on the iCloud servers, just as an added backup. You don't want to lose any of your iOS data. So do that first. And then you certainly can delete the backups that are up in iCloud. And you could do it either from your iOS device or from your Mac. So if you want to do it from your iOS device, what you're going to do is you're going to tap on settings, you're going to go in and tap on the iCloud icon, and then tap the storage and backup option. And then from there, go ahead and tap manage storage, and then you will see your backups that are already up in iCloud there. Tap on the particular backup that you want to delete. That will drill down one more screen into that backup area, and from there, you should see the delete backup button. When you tap that, you'll be asked to confirm that that's what you want to do, and that will delete the backup from iCloud. Also be aware that it will also turn off backups for that device on iCloud on iOS, so you're going to have to re-enable those, which is what you want to do anyway. So I think the net result is going to be what you want. If you want to do this from the Mac, you need to go into your system preferences. So you can go under the Apple menu, choose system preferences, and then click on the iCloud system preferences, and then go ahead and click the manage button to view the stored data. From there, you're going to click on the backups tab and then find the specific backup in the list that you want to remove, and then delete it from iCloud. Select the delete option to have it deleted from iCloud. Again, it's going to ask you to confirm the change, and it's also going to turn off the backups of your iOS device, and you're going to remove that from the iCloud service. So once again, you're going to want to go back in and re-enable those. Just as a side note, when you're in there on your iOS device, in addition to the backups, you can also look under the Documents and Data section of the iCloud settings to see the different kinds of files that different applications are storing up in iCloud if you're using iCloud storage for those apps. And you can drill into those specific apps, and it'll sometimes give you the option to delete specific documents by simply swiping over their names. So swiping left to right over the name of the file within that view, and then it will pop up a delete button. You can actually delete directly from there rather than going into the app itself. Again, just be careful with that, because if you delete it in the data and documents section of the settings, you're also going to be removing it from the application itself. But another way to kind of free up some data. So Patrick, I hope that helps solve your problem, and good luck with your new iCloud backups and additional storage. And with that, that is going to do it for this episode of the MacCast. Before I leave you, I do want to take a second and thank all of my show sponsors. Circus Ponies, makers of Notebook. You can get free trials of their application as well as more information and details over at circusponies.com. Smile, they make Text Expander, PDF Pen, Disk Label, also Text Expander Touch and PDF Pen for iPhone and iPad. Check out all of their stuff as well as get free trials of the Mac applications over at smilesoftware.com. Gazelle, what's your iPhone, your iPad worth? Take a minute to find out. Go to gazelle.com and get your offer today. Squarespace. You know, if you need to build a great looking website that's maintainable and you want to do it in minutes, not hours or days, you can do that with Squarespace. You can try it completely free. Just go to squarespace.com/Maccast to sign up now. And if you make a purchase, you can get 10% off your order by entering the offer code MACCAST1. ShareFile by Citrix. Take all the hassle out of sharing and sending those business files via old methods like email attachments and FTP with ShareFile. Try it risk-free for 30 days. Just go to ShareFile.com, click on the radio microphone, and be sure to enter my offer code MACCAST. And a big thank you to all of my sponsors for their support of the show. We've got Macworld iWorld coming up in just a week or so. It's going to happen on January 31st through February 2nd, 2013, in San Francisco at Moscone Center. I'm going to be recording a live MacCast from the show floor, and I'd love to have you there. I'd love to have you there in the audience. It's on Friday, February 1st from 2:30 to 3:30. So if you're in town for the show, be sure to check that out. And I want to interview Macworld attendees and MacCast fans and listeners about why they come to the show, the kinds of things they're seeing and doing at the show. If you'd like to participate in that, please email me and let me know if you're interested in being on the air, and I will try and get you scheduled. I have had a couple of you email me already, and we're getting people lined up. If you need free expo hall passes, you can get in completely free to participate on that. I have details up on the MacCast Facebook page or on the Google Plus community, or just email me and I'll have a link to get a free hall pass in the show notes at maccast.com, and I look forward to seeing you there. Also, this weekend on Saturday, we have our Mac Geek Day at Disneyland. If you watch my Instagram feed, you likely know I'm a big fan of Disney, and so are a lot of Mac geeks. David Sparks, Mac Sparky, and I thought it would be a lot of fun to have a bunch of us get together for a day at Disneyland. It's really kind of an informal meetup. We've set the date this Saturday, January 26th. So if you're in town, you happen to be in the area, we'd love to have you come out. Basically, it's just a chance for a bunch of us to get together in the same general area and have some fun. I think we're going to take a photo. We've kind of worked out the schedule. We're going to meet around 11 a.m. in front of the castle in Disneyland, and we're going to do a quick photo, and then we're going to go off and have some lunch. I think we're going to go over to Pizza Port, which is over in Tomorrowland, and eat there. Probably be there around 11:30. I'm going to have details up on our website, DisneyMacGeeks.com, so you can go there to get all of the details, and there's a link there. If you could just let us know that you're coming, there's a little event on the Google Plus community. I think we have about 14, 15 people signed up at this point, and we'd love to have more. So just let us know, and it should be a lot of fun. That's going to do it for this week. Please keep your emails, your audio comments coming. I love hearing from you. If you have a question, a comment, something you want to let me know about, you can shoot email to maccast@gmail.com. You can also call in on the listener hotline, leave a voicemail. That's 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IAM-9. And there's also voicemail on Skype. You can reach me at the Skype address, The MacCast. Leave voicemail there. If you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you'll find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. While you're there, be sure to check out the MacCast forum at forum.maccast.com. And if you'd like to follow me on social media, I'm on Twitter, twitter.com/MacCast. Also, the MacCast Facebook page at facebook.com/TheMacCast. And we have our Google Plus community over on Google Plus. Just search for MacCast on Google, and I'm sure it'll pop right up. And so I think that brings us to a close. Thanks for listening. And until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.